It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
It's a controversial form of ostracism, a tool in bringing down those with power, canceling. Some see it as accountability and a method of calling attention to long-standing injustice. They say it's always been around. Others see a new, virulent form of mob justice, which jeopardizes a person's safety and risks indefinite alienation. Either way, in this modern era, social media has a decidedly amplifying effect. It's against that background we debate for and against this motion, cancel culture is toxic. Hi, everybody. And yes, we are talking about lately what's being called cancel culture, the perception, at least, and possibly the reality that there has been an outbreak of people being punished for the ideas they express through a process of public shaming that is seen to be silencing them, to getting them ejected from positions of prominence, even to ending their careers. There is much disagreement on whether cancel culture is even real or exaggerated, or whether it's really something new, and whether it is toxic to public discourse or a necessary corrective to have these call-outs. Cancel culture on trial, that's our debate. I'm John Donvan, and this is Intelligence Squared. All right, everybody, now you have a duty to perform here in this program, and that is to act as the judge of the debate, each one of you. What we would like you to do is to tell us which side you feel argued the best, and we're going to ask you to do that by voting on our motion, cancel culture is toxic, before you've even heard the arguments, and then we're going to ask you to vote after you've heard what everyone has to say. And here at Intelligence Squared, we name as our winner the team whose numbers go up the most in percentage point terms between the first and the second vote. The first vote, it's right now. And here's what we would like you to do. Go to IQ2US.org. That's IQ2US.org in a web browser. And you will get to a multiple choice field where you will tell us whether you are for, against, or undecided on the statement, cancel culture is toxic. I'll give you just one more second to get that first vote in. And now, all right, it is time to meet our debaters.
Arguing for the motion, cancel culture is toxic, is Garry Kasparov, Russian chess grandmaster and pro-democracy activist. He is currently chairman of the Human Rights Foundation, a nonprofit that promotes human rights globally. His partner, Camille Foster, a media entrepreneur and political commentator, and co-host of the Fifth Column podcast. Foster was one of the signatories of the much-discussed Harper's Letter and its call for free speech and open debate. Opposing them, Karen Atiyah, a Washington Post columnist who writes on issues related to race, international politics, gender, and human rights. She is author of Say Your Word, Then Leave, and was a Fulbright scholar to Ghana. Her partner, Eric Hatala Mathis, an author and moral philosophy professor at Wellesley College. He is the author of the book Drawing the Line, What to Do with the Work of Immoral Artists from Museums to the Movies.
Okay, now here we all are assembled to begin this debate. I just want to say to all four of you, thanks so much for joining us on Intelligence Squared.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
All right, so let's go into our first round. One is made up of opening statements from each debater in turn. These openings will be 4 minutes each. Our motion is cancel culture is toxic. And speaking first for the motion, here is Camille Foster. Camille, the screen is yours.
Thanks so much, John. And thank you to Intelligence Square for hosting this, I think, very important debate. I have to begin by making a bit of an awkward admission. I dislike cancel culture, which is probably not surprising in some respects, but I mean in a very specific sense, I dislike cancel culture because I find the phrase a bit frustrating. It's aesthetically not so satisfying. I think it has almost a satirical quality to it. It kind of conjures these images of mean girls, of people engaging in these rather trivial kind of social media cyberbullying. But what we're talking about here is a fair bit more serious and sinister than that. It is a dynamic that is a real and in many respects definable and easily discernible aspect of American society, of American politics, and of American culture. And it is having a meaningful impact on how our institutions operate, on our relationship to truth, and on core philosophical ideals and values like free speech and free inquiry that are indispensable for our social project, regardless of what values people think they're defending when they participate in these mobbings. Now, I've been participating in these conversations in one respect or another for a very long time. And I'm pleased that we've gotten beyond the point where we have to debate whether or not cancel culture is a thing at all. We do know that cancel culture is real. Most Americans recognize that in numerous polls and surveys from across the sort of ideological spectrum, and numerous media organizations have confirmed as much. And to kind of operate in the universe of definitions briefly, cancel culture is a dynamic where various tactics are used, and I would say abused, for the purposes of exercising social power to silence debate. Often this is fueled by social media controversies and takes place on social media platforms, but it's hardly limited to that medium. Again, these campaigns are consequential, and they're also, yes, toxic. The campaigns are also swift. They're generally incurious, and they're often brutally unforgiving. There is generally not an opportunity for people who are accused to kind of appeal to evidence, to muster any sort of defense for themselves. And the dynamics that facilitate the social intimidation that's used to fuel these campaigns often intimidate even their friends, their coworkers, their family members from speaking out publicly for fear that they'll receive the same sort of treatment. In a nutshell, what cancel culture does is it paralyzes the free flow of ideas and information that goes against particular ideological dogmas. It is an attempt to win arguments, not by engaging with the substance of what's on offer, but by making debate completely impossible, by essentially pulling out the rug from underneath your opponent. And this is distressingly something that, again, numerous polls have suggested is very real. And the belief that it is real amongst the public is something that transcends partisan and ideological boundaries. Even amongst Democrats who identify as somewhat liberal and very liberal, it is not so much that a majority, but a very uncertain majority might say that they don't believe cancel culture is a severe problem, but as many as 41% by some measures indicate that they do believe that this is a problem, that they do feel that they have to shield their political values, their views in certain cases, for fear that they might be punished in some way. And nearly a third of these same kinds of people suggest that they fear that they might lose their jobs as a result of this.
Thank you very much, Camille Foster. And that is your opening statement. Our next statement will be against the resolution that cancel culture is toxic. Here is Eric Attala-Mathis. Eric, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, John. And thanks to Intelligence Squared for hosting this important debate. I'm glad to be here arguing against this resolution. So I'm going to sort of lay out the framework of our argument, and then Karen will be filling in with some cases and details and further considerations. So when we think about a resolution like this, cancel culture is toxic, we need to be really clear about the meaning of the key terms in order to be in a position to evaluate the resolution. So toxic, that's not very controversial, but it's worth being explicit. Something that's toxic is pervasively harmful, right? So harmful in a widespread way. Cancel culture, on the other hand, much more controversial. And we're going to argue that there is no clear and consistent definition of cancel culture that one can demonstrate is, in fact, pervasively harmful. Right? That's our position. So what might cancel culture be? So you might think that cancel culture is constituted by public shaming, largely on the internet. But in a political culture where we have normalized expressions of prejudice and bigotry, not arguments necessarily, public shaming is a perfectly legitimate response, right, as a means of engaging in social resistance against those expressions. Moreover, right, as we've seen, when people engage in critiques of cancel culture that are based on a commitment to freedom of speech, right, these acts of, you know, so-called public shaming, I would say social resistance, are themselves just more speech. So that seems like an inconsistency in the other side's argument. Now, you might say that cancel culture isn't just about public shaming. It's also about the loss of jobs or opportunities, the function of that public shaming. But in fact, it seems like cases where people do lose their jobs as a function of being canceled are vanishingly small. And indeed, it seems like often it's more likely that people acquire new opportunities as a function of being canceled, speaking opportunities, book deals, etc. So it's really hard to see how the claim that being canceled is harmful is supposed to be established. Moreover, you know, I think there's an inconsistency in the way that critics of cancel culture talk about what counts as cancel culture. So there are a range of cases where we do see people losing jobs or opportunities, but conveniently, these seem to not be part of what critics typically think of as cancel culture when they're criticizing it. So you think of, you know, Hannah Nicole Jones or even Colin Kaepernick, you know, people who have lost jobs or opportunities because of political stances. And yet, right, those cases don't count as part of cancel culture, according to most of cancel culture's critics. Right. So that, again, seems like an inconsistency in how we're thinking about what cancel culture is. So those are three reasons, I think, to reject this resolution, because it doesn't seem like there is a clear and consistent definition of cancel culture that we can demonstrably show is in fact pervasively harmful. I think that's really all our side needs to show, but I think that we can do you one better. I think that we can show not only that this resolution is false, but the resolution itself is toxic. This idea that cancel culture is out there and is harming people is a shield that people in positions of power use to try to avoid reasonable critique of things that they do and that they say. Right? And the fact, like, that Camille mentioned, that so many people believe that cancel culture exists is really just a function of the way in which media attention has put it out there as this specter, right? And then people in positions of power hide behind it. So I think that you should vote against this resolution because it is both false and itself harmful. Thanks.
You've been listening to Intelligence Squared US. I'm John Donvan. This is a reminder to all of you that Intelligence Squared US is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. Our mission is to restore critical thinking and facts and reason and civility to American public discourse. We would love your support. Please visit www.intelligencesquaredus.org to join the debate and hear from both sides of every issue. More debate when we return.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Welcome back. I'm John Donvan, and this is Intelligence Squared US. Let's jump right back into our discussion.
Thank you very much, Eric Hatala-Mathis. And here's where you are. We are halfway through the opening round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. You have heard from the first two debaters, and now on to the third. Speaking next in support of the motion that cancel culture is toxic, here is Garry Kasparov. Garry, the screen is all yours.
We are gathered, virtually, to debate a vital topic in the world where freedom is on the run, on the decline. Just a few short decades ago, liberal democracy for all was considered inevitable. The Iron Curtain fell, the Soviet Union collapsed, and trust me, it felt much better for those of us on the other side. The old Soviet joke went, in the Soviet Union, we have freedom of speech. But in the United States, they also have freedom after speech. All these freedoms we envied of are now under threat everywhere, including the United States, still the freest country in the world. And most troubling, many threats are against the institutions that are so essential to protecting intellectual freedom. Schools and universities are where we most need to challenge and be challenged. But how can we learn what's right if we are afraid to ever be wrong? The increasingly you hear, we'll tell you what's right and good. But it reminds me too much of the ideological education I grew up with back then in the Soviet Union. You disagreed, you were wrong. You were wrong too loudly, you were silenced. The good news is that the United States is not Russia or the Soviet Union. No one is going to be sent to Gulag for failing to toe the line. But just because there's no party with capital P does not mean there is no party line. There's still no Big Brother yet. But the effectiveness of the modern platforms like Twitter and Facebook to stifle the debate. So it's an enabling online mobs, creates a threat, the threat to the free flow of ideas that are silenced by socially unchallengeable views. In our Renew Democracy Initiative project, dissidents from around the world shared their alarm about how the United States is suppressing the very freedoms they're fighting for in their home countries. The United States today, so as is pointed out by the activists from China to Belarus to Zimbabwe to Venezuela to Cuba to Iran, so it's creating an intellectual environment that is closing in a way so painfully familiar to these activists. And these attitudes are toxic at any dosage. So our best defense is the values of the free world and protecting these values. It doesn't mean putting up with intolerance or promoting hatred. It doesn't require courage. The courage to defend the views and rights of those who you don't agree with. Our response must be more openness, more debate, more freedom. And today you can do your part by voting for intellectual freedom and against toxic spread of intolerance and groupthink and ideological purity tests. Thank you.
Thank you, Garry Kasparov. And our final speaker in this opening round will be speaking against the resolution that cancel culture is toxic. Here is Karen Atiyah. Karen, the screen is yours.
Thanks so much. And thank you for having me. Yes, again, I would like to advocate in advance for why your audiences should vote no against this resolution. I would back up my teammate Eric and say I still see that our opponents, again, well, our friends, but for today opponents, have not convincingly provided concrete evidence and concrete proof that A, that this is a pervasive part of American culture, and B, that this is toxic, or implying that this is infecting our culture so much that our entire society is unraveling, that this is in danger of unraveling the American project itself. Now, again, I'm a member of the media, and I will admit that the media, we tend to focus on powerful and prominent people who complain that their views are being challenged, who complain that their book deals and that their sponsorship deals and that their comedy specials are being protested. And we tend to focus on a small, very vocal, very prominent people who complain about this. But again, I think we should take a step back. I was just looking at a Gallup poll from last month about what most Americans see as their top important problem in America. And most of them did cite, 21% or so, cited the C word as their top priority. And you know what that C word was? That was coronavirus, an actual disease that is actually threatening the well-being and the stability of this country. I even tried to be generous and tried to look for anything that could look as a proxy to cancel culture. I looked at maybe free speech concerns, were they there? Censorship concerns, were they there? They were not. Most Americans outside of our blue check brigade, outside of our elite bubbles, and I think we can say we're a part of a certain elite bubble of Americans, most are worried about just their day-to-day lives. And those who are not sitting on Twitter all day are just not. So again, it's really for us to say, is this really unraveling American culture? And in reality, the ones who seem to claim the most that they've been canceled again, are they really buried? Woody Allen, take him. He's still got his book deal. Bill Cosby, convicted of sexual assault, that was overturned. Or even the bad boy today, Dave Chappelle, who's now a subject of into these cancel culture wars. He's rich, he's still famous, and Netflix is still standing behind him on a $24 million deal. So right now, the moment that we are in, what we're talking about is not so much cancel culture, which again, mind you, originated from Black communities who were using whatever power of shaming that they had to call out harmful, toxic behavior towards them as a group. Is now being used as a pejorative. I do not see it as a coincidence that cancel culture is now being somewhat turned against marginalized communities as a way to stifle what is actually happening, which is actually the opening of space. We have more voices than ever before, Latinx voices, non-binary voices, transgender voices, who are now speaking and who are now speaking out against those systems and those who perpetuate the systems that have long participated in what I would say is a erasure culture, which has led to generational wealth being disappeared, what has led to incarceration, what has led to a deep systemic continued erasure. And I would say this is the same for women in Me Too. So it's not an accident to me that this supposed bogeyman of cancel culture is really status anxiety, is discomfort at the fact that there's more voices, is discomfort at the fact that the gatekeepers are now seeing that they could be outside the gates of privilege and power. Now, again, I think this is the reason why we should vote against the resolution, because what we're debating at all, lives of the marginalized should never be debated. But what I think we should embrace is a culture of what's happening, and which is that there's more debate, more voices, and more people who are being moved to the center of American democracy and discourse.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Karen Atiyah. And that concludes round one of our Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our resolution is cancel culture is toxic. Now we move on to round two. And in round two, the debaters have a conversation, address one another directly, and also take some questions from me. But just in terms of what I'm hearing, the team arguing for the motion that cancel culture is toxic are talking about a situation, a dynamic that they consider frightening and widespread, in which people with holding certain views that are not considered acceptable by others are facing a kind of punitive process of shaming that has real consequences. Among those consequences, I think they're saying that there's a tendency for a chilling effect on dialogue and discourse in general. That means that only one view will ultimately dominate, and that it's shutting down the spirit of inquiry and free speech that they say is essential to the American project. The team arguing against the resolution are arguing a few different things. One, they question whether cancel culture, as expressed by their opponents, is really real. Even if it's real in tiny doses, they argue that it's not deep and it's not pervasive, that in fact the calling out that happens can actually be beneficial. And they make the argument that those who are citing cancel culture in a derogatory, pejorative way are using it as a shield to defend themselves against criticism that they don't like hearing. So I want to go to you, Camille Foster, first, and say that this question of the cancel culture claim being a shield that your opponent Eric raised, that he's questioning whether the whole phenomenon, the whole dynamic, is as deep, widespread, and as toxic as the resolution implies, and kind of accuses your side of playing a double game of not only challenging cancel culture, but using the term to protect against criticism that you're one doesn't like to hear, those who are citing it. So I'd like you to take on that that description of what it means for you to be arguing that cancel culture is toxic.
Yeah, I think Eric made a number of rather dubious claims, frankly. First, the assertion that cancel culture is difficult to define and thus because of its nebulous qualities should be dismissed out of hand, I think is rather absurd. Love, hate, freedom, various other things that no one would dispute exist are all somewhat difficult to define, but again, nevertheless exist and have real and profound consequences in the world. I think the fact that polling consistently has demonstrated that people believe cancel culture that is there, whether one believes that is a result of the media sensationalizing or because of realities that they experience in their everyday lives, actually illustrates our point. The question of how toxic this is, how bad this is an important one. But I would actually like to posit another question. Is it possible that in pursuit of some just ends, one might overcorrect, that one might imperil particular values? It is another demonstrated reality that surveys suggest repeatedly that an increasing number of Americans think there should be curtailment of free speech for the purposes of protecting certain classes of citizens. That is a real dynamic that's happening. It's something that is playing out in the polling and can't be dismissed in an arbitrary fashion. I think you have a difficult circumstance for yourself when you're both simultaneously suggesting that something like is being inconsistently applied because certain cancellations on the left perhaps aren't being called out by some hypocritical conservatives. I would submit to you that the hypocrisy is real and so are the cancellations. And whether or not the consequences of these cancellations are devastating for particular individuals, that's a complicated story. The reality is beyond someone who actually has their lives disrupted by a cancellation, there is a universe of people who stay silent because they fear cancellation. And that is the dynamic we're concerned about.
So Eric Catala-Mathis, what's your response to what you heard from Camille on that?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I'm happy to hear Camille say that like he wants to include, right, a sort of like a broader set of responses to people's actions in, you know, this supposed cancel culture umbrella. So at least where you can sort of like remove, right, the inconsistency, which you see in a lot of the criticisms of cancel culture, where they don't include, right, any ways in which people are subject to reprisal when their views are more on the political left. But I think that, you know, one of the challenges that we confront here, and I think you see this in some of the comments that Gary made in his opening, is we have sort of a general conflation of a bunch of different ideas. And this is really what I was getting at when I said there's no clear and consistent understanding of culture, cancel culture at play. So like on the one hand, we have things like, you know, the sort of online response to things that people say, right? And the other hand, you know, Gary's talking about like state-sanctioned suppression, right? Those are totally different things, right? And so like when we have such an ambiguous set of things that we're supposed to be saying like, oh, this whole thing, right, is toxic, I think it sort of undermines the force of the point. I completely agree with you that state-sanctioned suppression is a bad thing. That is toxic. But I just don't think that's what we're talking about when we're usually talking about cancel culture.
I quickly look at my notes and I didn't recall that I ever said something about state oppression or central authority in the United States. Of course, I cited my Soviet experience and I tried to share the concerns of dozens and dozens of prominent dissidents around the world who are really, you know, alarmed by this development in the United States. And you're talking about people who experienced the attacks on individual freedoms and especially on freedom of speech in their countries, just across the globe. Of course, America is far from being there, and that's what I said. But, you know, we have instruments like Twitter and Facebook and all the social media that allows the mobilization of online mob that attacks people. And while Karen said, oh, it's the Dave Chappelle is still there or J.K. Rowling. Yes, they're too big. So that is too big to be canceled. But the effect it has on millions of others who saw that even these giants can be under attack. So and Camille quoted a few polls that indicated and demonstrated that more than half of the Americans, you know, really concerned about, you know, what would be the consequences of them exercising their rights of the free speech.
Karen, you want to jump in?
Yeah, again, I just see a conflation of a whole bunch of different points. One thing I would point out, as the sole woman on this panel, I also look at, I find it interesting to see when these terms, woke, cancel culture, enter our consciousness. And to me, it seems cancel culture seemed to really enter the consciousness after the Me Too movement. And I remember a lot of men, especially, sitting on their head, really worried that maybe they would be canceled too, like Harvey Weinstein, because now women were speaking up or speaking out and were calling for accountability and were calling for consequences. And I think ultimately, what people, what women in particular were calling for was for a reform of how we treat us and how we treat each other in this system. So I think to a certain extent, it goes back to my point, which is I was trying to make, when cancel culture enters the lexicon, when woke enters the lexicon after, you know, the power and the force of Black voices, of Black protests. Now we're seeing, you know, CRT. I just look at the fear of cancel culture being this pervasive thing. I actually do think that men, people in power, cishet people, I actually do think there is a discomfort. Is that toxic? I don't think so. I think it's uncomfortable, and I can see that and I can acknowledge that. But what is more uncomfortable or more toxic? Women, Black people, people of color who've been marginalized for a long time, who've had their careers destroyed by those who have used their power, who've used the systems to silence women, to use NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, to use lawsuits, to use threats, actual physical threats of violence against those who do not have the power of the system to work for them. So I look at this and I'm kind of like, the whole thing is sort of disingenuous, because it's just really interesting who the groups that perpetuate, you know, woke is being pejorative, cancel culture is being pejorative. And I would just, again, like to say, I don't think we have a very, we can talk about digital culture and bots, online harassment. I've been a victim of that. I've seen that, and I've seen that. However, I still speak and I still write, and there are plenty who still choose to do so. Does it make it that we're in a new environment? Yes. But I actually embrace the culture that we're in right now, because again, more voices are involved. There is actually less canceling in some ways going on. There's less erasure, there's more visibility. And so to try to dismiss that by saying, oh, we're afraid of the new voices, maybe you should reconsider whether or not maybe public discourse is your thing.
I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared US. We'll hear more from our debaters right after this. Welcome back to Intelligence Squared US. I'm John Donvan. Let's get back to our debate.
Well, I wonder if I could interject something, Karen, because it seems that, you know, one of the accusations that was leveled at our side is that, you know, we have this rather nebulous definition and it's hard to prove. An assertion is continually made on the other side that minorities are being sort of disempowered, that the motivation for people who are concerned about cancel culture is that they are afraid of losing control, that they want to sort of disempower women who are raising legitimate concerns about being mistreated. I think it's worth noting that the same polling does, in fact, break out certain demographic groups that, when asked, does the political climate these days prevent me from saying things I believe? 49% of African-American respondents said that they agreed with that sentiment. 65% of Latino respondents said they agreed with that sentiment. 65% of Asian respondents said they agreed with that sentiment. And while men certainly do get a bit higher in terms of 65% of men, 59% of women seem to agree with that sentiment. I think it's disingenuous to insist that the people who are raising these concerns don't share a number of the social justice related and certainly criminal justice reform issues that have been brought to the fore since the summer of last year when I signed the Harper's Letter. And I did so alongside more than 150 prominent academics and social commentators and creatives and entrepreneurs, all of whom are well to the left of me, all of whom expressed a tremendous amount of sympathy for and support for the Black Lives Matter protests. And generally, myself personally, I've advocated, I've spent hundreds of hours personally working on issues of criminal justice reform. And my company, Freethink, publishes on this constantly. I would submit to you that if we are raising concern about this in that context, that there is perhaps a legitimate concern that ought to be taken seriously. And to use a word that you used a moment ago, not dismissed. I do not dismiss legitimate concerns about policing, about social justice. My concern is that a world where we are fighting those battles by purging people from our polite society and by preventing them from having an ability to sort of make arguments in certain contexts is disadvantageous to minority groups who want to feel protected.
But Camille, is that really happening? Come on. I mean, in the sense of, and I remember the Harper's letter and had thoughts about it, but the thoughts I would say now is it's not even so much a right-left issue. It's not so much, I have a lefty friend who agrees. That Harper's letter, and I would say, all of us in this room, we belong to a certain class that has visibility, that has prominence, that has power, that has platforms, right? The fact that you're able to come back on this platform, and I feel like that we're able to speak about that means that it belongs to a certain, again, group, and we belong to a certain power structure that does have the power to shape discourse and to shape thought.
I want to bring Eric and Gary back into the conversation a little bit more, and I want to do that, Eric, by taking to you that the sort of pushback from previously marginalized communities is actually kind of a social good, that now communities that didn't have a voice and could not stand up to people who are complaining about cancel culture now can. But I'm wondering what the goal is. Is the goal merely to be heard, or is the goal of pushing back to silence the other side, to punish the other side, to remove the other side from positions of power? Because that's what your opponents, I think, are saying cancel culture is about. It's not just having an opposing point of view and being heard. They're complaining that it's a power play, again, similar to the Soviet Union, to silence the views that they don't want to have out there and to punish those who hold those views. I want to ask you, is that an accurate description of the motivation of people who are pushing back against those in power by calling them out?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, John. I mean, I, of course, can't speak to the motivations of anybody who participates in social activism that might be lumped into this cancel culture umbrella. I think that a lot of people who get, pegged with this cancel culture label are really looking for institutional reform. And they're doing that, right, via, right, protesting or calling out behavior of particular individuals. I think that there are occasions when the sort of focus on the speech of particular individuals can actually be a bit of a distraction from those more institutional aims. But I think if you really pay attention to what activists are saying, that's what they want, right? So to like go back to this recent Chappelle case, right? So like Dave Chappelle is like out there being like, oh, I'm being canceled. But who lost their job, right? The trans employee at Netflix who helped to organize, right, the walkout in protest is the one who lost their job. And they published an op-ed in the Washington Post where they said explicitly, they were like, I'm not trying to cancel Dave Chappelle. We're talking about working towards changes at this institution, right, that they work at. And I think that's really ultimately what a lot of activism is geared towards, is sort of making changes at the institutional level. They're going to influence what we are ultimately exposed to. Critics of cancel culture focus a lot on the sort of after the fact, right? Like, what's the response to speech? But that just obscures the many ways in which people are canceled, right, before the fact, because of the way that our institutions are set up, right? So, Karen was talking about publishing, right? The publishing industry is 82% white. That's going to affect the kind of content that gets produced, right? So what are people really agitating for? I think they're agitating for institutional reform that's going to yield a more diverse set of voices without some, right, being pushed to the top where they need to sometimes be protested against.
Gary, just want you to jump into the conversation with what you're thinking.
Yes, our opponents are just trying to push the debate so just in the opposite direction, I'm still struggling to understand the how coherent this argument, but basically they try to politicize everything and pretend that, you know, the cancel culture is an invention of those who are trying to stay in power. Camille responded that 99% of those who signed the Harper letter, you know, they were on the left of the political center, and they probably do not differ very much with Eric and Karin on many political issues. But they expressed concern about the threat, an explicit threat to the freedom of speech. One of, by the way, signatories was J.K. Rowling, who was immediately attacked. And that's classic, you know, this is the way that the cancel culture operates. It's not about the content, but it's about an individual.
This concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our resolution is cancel culture is toxic. So here's where we are. We are about to hear brief closing statements from each debater in turn. These statements will be 2 minutes each, and it's their last chance to try to change your minds, because right after this, we're going to ask you to vote for that second time. So here, making his final statement in support of the motion, cancel culture is toxic, here is Camille Foster.
Well, thank you for that, John. I'm going to deviate from my planned comments here. I think what's really important to underscore is that when we talk about a culture of free speech, as opposed to the legal protections that are afforded to all Americans by the Constitution, protecting them from the government interfering with their ability to speak, this culture of free speech is something that directly relates to our ability to engage in civil discourse, to have open dialogue, to debate important issues. It actually creates opportunities for minority viewpoints to be expressed in public. It is part of the framework that had allowed for the robust activism of the civil rights movement. We know that when people were engaged in things like, say, a counter demonstration where they came and they sat in at some sort of dining establishment that had been previously discriminatory, their goal was very simple. They wanted to be included. They didn't want to be forcefully excluded from different environments on account of their race. They achieved their goal and they used that culture and those tools. And that is precisely what I am most concerned about and what Gary is most concerned about and what so many people who are worried about cancel culture are concerned about. Our cultural willingness to engage with ideas that are not our own, our willingness to forcefully rebut when necessary, but also to explore possibilities that exist amongst people who we may not interact with on a regular basis. On university campuses in particular, this manifests itself in a number of pernicious ways. You have publication bias, a very real phenomenon where people won't even ask particular questions if they fear that they run afoul of some sort of sacred zeitgeist. We don't need dogmas. What we need is a culture of free speech that values genuine inclusiveness and that puts the hard work of confronting bad ideas where it belongs, with us.
Thank you, Camille Foster. And next up to be making an argument, his closing argument against the resolution that cancel culture is toxic, here is Eric Hatala-Mathis.
So I'm going to tell a quick story that I think illustrates the arguments that we've been making today. The French painter Paul Gauguin engaged in sexual abuse of Tahitian girls. And so some people, in responding to those facts, have argued that we need to do a better job of contextualizing his work in museums, right? We need to be honest about the things that he did and their relevance to our understanding of his work. So the New York Times ran an article about this a couple years ago, and that very point is the most critical point that was made in the article, right? That we shouldn't take Gauguin's paintings down, but we should take his actions seriously, right? And contextualize the work. What was the article titled? Is it time Gauguin got canceled? So this is just the perfect illustration of the way in which the specter of cancel culture is used to obscure attention from the very legitimate and plausible criticisms that people sometimes make in response, right, to immoral phenomenon. And if you're not, right, particularly compelled by cases about the arts, right, consider that on the heels of the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th, when people were critical of the fact that the then President Donald Trump was not taking a stronger stand against the insurrection, Representative Jim Jordan said, "Oh, people are trying to cancel him." That's what the idea of cancel culture ends up doing. It functions as a shield so that people can try to avoid legitimate criticism. And that is why you should vote against this resolution.
Thank you very much, Eric. And here to make his final argument in a closing statement in support of the motion, cancel culture is toxic, Garry Kasparov.
As the saying goes, the solution for the problems with free speech is just bringing more free speech. Terrible ideas can and should be confronted without promoting those who hold them. People should be held accountable, but they should not be held hostage. I'm not afraid for myself. I've faced real mobs, not just Twitter mobs. I've had my Russian website banned in Putin's Russia, my offices raided, my friends and colleagues beaten, jailed, or worse. The victims of cancel culture are not multimillionaire authors or famous comedians. But seeing them attacked so viciously sends a clear message to those who do not have their protections and advantages. The real victims are the same people who always suffer most when fundamental rights come under attack. They will stay quiet and even paralyzed while the powerful and entitled get louder. That is real, that is dangerous, and that is toxic. And meanwhile, we are all debating here, and it's privilege. And I doubt that any one of us would like to live in a world where it couldn't happen. In a world where we could be scared for our career or for our families because we might say something tonight. I have lived already in two of these worlds, and I'm here arguing because I don't want to live in the third. And I urge you to support the proposition. So my American-born kids do not repeat the experience of their Soviet-born father. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Garry Kasparov. And finally, with our last argument, it will be against the resolution that cancel culture is toxic. Here is, please, Karen Atiyah.
Thanks so much. Again, I would like to urge audiences to vote no against this resolution, cancel culture being toxic. Our opponents have made all sorts of statements and all sorts of expressed their fears about a supposed very, very evil and dark turn that the U.S. is going down. But so far we've come full circle on just, it's a mishmash of ideas about what cancel culture really is. And I would propose a different way to look at what's really happening. And what is really happening is a cultural shift on multiple levels, on multiple fronts. And what is happening is cultural shifts have always been uncomfortable. Norms changing have always been uncomfortable. Generational divides and differences have always been uncomfortable. And I think what is happening is that the blinds are being taken off of so many people who have long been subjected to, frankly, erasure by our society. And so what I would say is that we're actually not in a moment of deep, deep toxicity or polarization. What is actually happening is that we are having more speech and there is more visibility and more healing and we're inching towards justice. And I actually fear that when these trends of cancel culture and wokeism and social justice warriors, what that actually is backlash to the progress that has been made, backlash to the progress that Me Too made, backlash to the progress that Black Lives Matter's made, backlash to the progress that trans and LGBT people have made in making themselves a little bit, just a little bit more of the center than they were before. And it's just unfortunate that them making themselves a little bit more of the center causes fear and status anxiety in those who've long had power. I think we are in a better place, and this new culture of inclusivity, this new culture of justice is one that I believe we should fully embrace, not see as toxic, but more see as us, as a society, trying to live up to our ideals.
Thank you, Karen Atiyah, and thank you to all of our debaters, because that concludes the final round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. All right, everybody, it's now time for our second vote. And remember, it's the side that changes the most minds between the first and the second vote that will be declared our winner. We're going to do this as the same way as before. we'd like you to go back to IQ2US.org, IQ2US.org, and there you will get the same choices to say that you are for, against, or undecided the statement that cancel culture is toxic. And as I mentioned earlier, we're keeping this vote open for 7 days. And at the end of those 7 days, we will announce a winner on our website, IQ2US.org. With that said, I want to say something to all four debaters. It was clear that you had some very sharp disagreements about the statement, the debate itself, the nuances, etc. What you all did, the way in which you brought you argued, all of you, honestly, without cynicism, with fact, with examples, and most of all, I think with respect for one another. That just came through. It's really, really what we aim for at Intelligence Squared. So thank you from me and from all of us at Intelligence Squared.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And now that the competition is over, I would like to say all of you who are joining us, that this really has been a good debate and the topic is extremely important. And in addition to thanking our debaters, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. We really appreciate your interest in this and what we do. We've been now doing this for many years, where we've done more than 200 debates at this level. We appreciate your support and your commitment. And as I say at the end of every debate, we're a nonprofit. We rely on the support of the public to keep this going. So if you would like to support us, we would love it. And you can do that by going to IQ2US.org, and there's going to be a chance there for you to donate to keep this going. We put it out to the world for free. It's used in schools around the country, at the high school level, even the elementary school level, and certainly at the college level. So you'll be taking part in an educational endeavor if you support us. I want to thank you, our audience, for tuning into this episode of Intelligence Squared. I hope that you enjoyed it just as much as we did. Intelligence Squared is a nonprofit generously funded by listeners like you and by the Rosencrantz Foundation. Claire Connor is our CEO. David Ariosto is head of editorial. Amy Kraft is chief of staff and leads production. And Shay O'Mara is our consulting producer. Jen Zelmer is our senior researcher. Damon Whittemore is our radio producer. Robert Rosencrantz is our chairman. And I'm your host, John Donvan.